Hello, you're listening to the Seeds Out of Movies. My name's Colin. I'm the C. Joining me is Zijan the Z. Hello, Zijan.
So, we're in a very awkward position right now, Colin, because, you know, we didn't really have a podcast last time around.
We didn't have a podcast last time.
But I still lost the quiz.
You did. So, for those who haven't heard my updates, I was very sad two weekends ago because we recorded an episode on Ant-Man and the Wasp: Quantumania. I thought it was a good episode. I thought we did.
Yeah, me
we,
too.
We did. We had fun. We covered all the points. Sometimes I get to the end of a podcast and think, oh, I forgot to say that, but I don't think that happened with Ant-Man. I think we covered everything in detail. And then I lost everything on my laptop, including my half of that conversation. So Zijan, your half of the conversation, we could publish, I suppose.
Yes, everyone likes to hear one-sided dialogue. That's why everyone wants to hear the podcast.
Doesn't the quiz be the best bit? Just hear silence, then you hear yeah. You going, I don't know. Yes, as Zijan references, I won the quiz and it still counts, even if we're the only two people
who've ever heard it. So ridiculous. Why is this nonsense?
I put so much research into that quiz. Hopefully this one will be heard by someone other than the two of us. I might upload it as soon as we finish, just in case
okay.
Nothing dies again. At least I can re-download it.
Yep, that's fair.
It does mean there's lots of news that we covered then that we're not going to talk about, I guess.
Nope.
And maybe one day we'll come back and do Woody Harrelson's films again, but who knows. This time we are talking about Creed 3. We're also doing a quiz on Reese Witherspoon romantic comedies. Yep. Looking back at the year. Yeah, I'm sure you'll tell us.
1952.
The year my mother was born. An Oscar-winning film, The Greatest Show on Earth. As we record, the Oscars have not happened.
Nope.
So we won't be covering those, but we'll have to do that one next time.
Yes.
And much more, of course. Zijan.
Yep.
What news have you got for us? I'll try to not lose it.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you mentioned Oscars earlier.
I did, 12 seconds ago.
12 seconds ago. Everything Everywhere All at Once is definitely gaining momentum.
Oh, yeah.
Winning lots and lots of other awards.
I got some stuff at the SAG Awards, got some stuff, didn't it?
They did. Mm. They basically got a record win in the SAG Awards, winning the most awards ever in the SAG, winning Best Actress, Best Cast, Best Supporting Actor, and Best Supporting Actress. They've won that. They've won the writer.
Who won Best Supporting?
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Did she?
Yeah.
Oh, well done her. That's a surprise. I mean, she was good, but okay.
Yep. They've also won the Writer Guild Awards. They won the Producer Guild Awards. They won the Director Guild Awards. I mean, they're pretty much... There's so much momentum now, really, just leading up to this Oscar race.
This could be the second year in a row, maybe more than that, that the Oscar-winning film, Best Picture film, was not released in Oscar season. Because after Coda kind of being released and no one noticing until suddenly it was in the Oscar thing. In fairness, everyone did notice this one, but it certainly wasn't released as an Oscar-bait film by any means.
It definitely wasn't, yeah. I love this film to no end, and partially because of my bias towards Michelle Yeoh, but I still love this film as well. As I've been watching a lot of reactions to this film on YouTube because it came out on, I believe, Amazon Prime. So a lot of YouTube streamers have been watching and reacting to it. And it's quite nice to relive that experience as well. So
Do you watch reaction videos on YouTube? Is that what these are?
Yeah, only for things that I enjoy watching, basically. Yeah, so
I suppose it's not quite... I guess a classic reaction video is when they just watch a trailer and go, whoa! Yeah. Oh, man. Oh, it's Batman. And I'm like, what are you doing?
I mean, they're clearly getting more viewers than we are on this podcast. That's so true. Must be doing something right. That's true.
Maybe we should start reacting to stuff. Yeah, I guess a bit like last year. We just don't know what's going to win. So you say Everything Everywhere is getting momentum, but obviously All Quiet on the Western Front swept the BAFTAs. Banshees was their favourite not that long ago. And
yeah, but BAFTAs are not really a good indicator at all. They've never been a good indicator of the Oscars.
No, fair enough. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. It's very, very Eurocentric, the BAFTAs.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, which usually means UK-centric, but not this year. We've got Germany. Is there a German film awards? There must be. Well, Quiet on the Western Front must have won absolutely every single one of them.
IGN recently did a count on the number of awards that Everything Everywhere All at Once has won.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently they've already beaten Lord of the Rings, Return of the King on that front as well.
Wow, okay.
So
I mean, that feels like it sounds more impressive than it is, because I don't know. I don't know if that means anything, but okay. Do you know what the most awards won by any film ever is?
It's 13, right?
I mean, not the Oscars, just in general.
Oh, no idea.
I mean, neither do I. I think it's 11, actually, Oscars, but...
They will come out a quiz one day.
Yeah. Ben-Hur, Lord of the Rings 3, and Titanic. And maybe Everything Ever at Once. Have they got 11 nominations?
No, only 10.
Well. I'm just Googling German Film Awards. Yeah, Deutscher Filmpreis, also known as the Lola. It's literally called German Film Award. I love the German.
Nice. I like it.
That's great. Anyway, I don't have anything Oscar related.
Are you trying to look for a segue? Just jump to something else then.
So the rom-com is back again. I think I mentioned this before when Reese Witherspoon and Ashton Kutcher made that really bad one. But Netflix are going back to that. Well, Nancy Meyer is back directing a film with the working title of Paris Paramount, starring Scarlett Johansson, who apparently replaced Jennifer Lawrence, Owen Wilson, Penelope Cruz, Michael Fassbender. It's got a $130 million budget.
Where does Netflix get their money? We've asked this question multiple times on this podcast and I still have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, they don't, I think is the short answer. They're just massively...
That's why they're preventing password sharing right now.
I just want to check that number because that just...
That's ridiculous.
That can't be true, can it?
For a rom-com as well.
For a rom-com. Come on. Between 130 million and 150 million, says...
Where's this rom-com set? In space?
I don't think so, unless they're beating Tom Cruise to the punch. I mean, that cast list is not cheap. I guess a lot of that money is going to Scarlett and Owen and where else.
But not 120 million.
No. The biggest rom-com budget ever is probably no more than 70. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you count the Titanic as a rom-com.
No. It's definitely, which part of the Titanic was comedic to you?
Like bit where the guy hit the propeller. Here we go. The top 10 most expensive rom-coms ever made. How Do You Know, which might be featuring in our Reese Witherspoon rom-com quiz later, apparently cost $120 million. And it was bad. Sex and the City 2, $100 million.
It's ridiculous.
Fun with Dick and Jane, $100 million. I'm looking down this list of the most expensive rom-coms ever.
And they're all pretty bad.
They're all pretty bad. I never saw It's Complicated. Apparently that was all right. 85 million. The Hitch, 70 million. Well, there you go. This one is shaping up to be the most expensive rom-com ever made. I mean,
you're going to watch it.
Of course I'll watch it. I just hope they've actually, you know, bothered putting any effort into it whatsoever, which they didn't with the last one.
Anyway.
I think it's the Nancy Meyer comeback. She hasn't been around for a while. But I'm trying to think what the Nancy Meyer hits are, if I'm honest.
She did the Parent Trap, right?
Oh, did she? Okay. Private Benjamin, I hear good things.
The Father of the Bride?
Yep, and part two and part three, which is a short film. Okay.
Yeah.
Something's Got to Give, The Holiday. In fact, a lot of the list of the most expensive rom-coms I just looked at are Nancy Meyer's films. There you go.
So, in our previous podcasts, we mentioned that Hellboy is coming back.
Yes.
But now, because you haven't heard the previous podcast, because that was all cut out, Hellboy, they're remaking Hellboy right now.
Because why not? Any third time's a charm.
Yep. And now they've got a cast. They've got the Hellboy, Jack Kesey.
I've never heard of him.
Neither have I. Apparently, he's been in Deadpool 2, very briefly, and Baywatch, apparently.
Ooh.
So there you go.
Ooh. Okay.
Great films.
I was sat next to someone on the plane. On a plane watching Baywatch and it looked bad from looking over his shoulder. Speaking of Deadpool 2, Hugh Jackman says that he'll be playing a dual role in Deadpool 3. It does feel very much like something he let slip accidentally in an interview for the film The Sun.
Uh-huh.
And Disney probably on the phone within 5 minutes saying, Hugh, stop doing this. but I mean, it doesn't tell us much. I know there's been speculation that he might play himself for some of it. You could have him playing different Wolverines from different timelines because I think it's generally accepted that the X-Men films are all over the shop. So one of the kinder analyses of the X-Men films is that they're all from different timelines.
Yep.
That was just, they couldn't be bothered to make them consistent.
I mean, we've gone out at this point now, right? I mean, we've already seen two bad Phoenix films, so...
Yeah. Roll on the third, I say. Keep making them. Yeah, I mean, unless they do something really weird, in which like they're going to bring Hugh Jackman in from all his films, which he's going to be the greatest showman. He's going to be Leopold from Keith and Leopold.
Oh, that, I think that'd be quite funny, though.
It'd be great. There's no way they got the rights to that, but it would be funny if they did.
Yeah. I'll watch that film. I'll watch that film. Oh, the yeah, I mean, it'd be like a Nicolas Cage film again, right?
It would. It would be like, what was it called? Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Did you watch that in the end?
No.
It's good. Just check it out.
Okay. Other Deadpool-related news. Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse has added Karan Soni. He's basically the taxi driver from the Deadpool universe. Yeah, so he's just lending his voice there.
Do we know who he's voicing yet?
No clue. There probably is another Spider-Man.
Yeah, because there's one from Mumbai. That's already in the. It's already been announced.
Is there? Oh, I didn't know that.
But I don't think he's voicing that. Star Wars news: films that we all thought were cancelled are still cancelled. It seems. So I think in the latest slate, the Kevin Feige produced film and the Patty Jenkins dogfight film are both gone.
It's not a good year for Patty Jenkins, is it?
No, I suppose it isn't.
It's only just begun, but still.
She's off Wonder Woman, she's off Star Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the speculation before is that this was trailed as like the best dogfight film ever, and then they made Top Gun Maverick. And it's like, okay, well, that's better than this, so let's not make this. If you run through the number of directors that Star Wars have kicked to the curb, it's getting longer and longer.
I wish I cared about it, but yeah. Maybe I'll watch The Mandalorian.
Yeah, it's not very good.
Is it not?
I just found it really boring.
Oh, okay. So then, no then.
I hear good things about Andor. I've not got to it yet, but I've heard it's good.
Yeah. John Cena, Simu Liu, and Awkwafina are starring in an action comedy, apparently, called Grand Theft Lotto. Paul Feig is directing the film. It's something like so in this film, in the near future, the Grand Lottery has been established in California, and the catch is that if you kill the winner before sundown, you can legally claim the prize.
Yeah, oh, it sounds a fun concept. It doesn't sound very comedic.
No, I think they can make it comedic, so long as you know they downplay the killing bit.
Yeah. Do you think that these are people who have won who are trying to avoid killers, or these are killers who are trying to kill the person, or a bit of both?
So I think from the synopsis, Awkwafina
plays. Does it? Okay.
Yeah, accidentally finds herself winning with a winning ticket. And must join forces with John Cena, who's a amateur jackpot protector, basically.
That's a great job.
Yeah. Yep. While dealing with a competitor played by Simu Liu, who's also an jackpot protector. Basically, they are hired guns to help protect the jackpot winner.
Okay, that's fun.
Yeah.
Of course, re-teaming Simu Liu and Awkwafina from Shang-Chi.
Shang-Chi.
David F. Sandberg, director of Shazam Fury of the Gods, which we'll be looking at next time, has said that apparently nothing in Shazam 2 contradicts what's in the DCU. So we might be getting more Shazam. I don't think we will.
I mean, the kids are getting on.
Yes, they're practically dead now. the last, Mary, I want to say, was in a film I saw last year called Fall, which is actually really good and has just gone to Netflix. So,
I saw the first 10 minutes of it and I didn't like it anymore.
All right.
It was very scary.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty scary. Yeah.
It was basically a free solo, but...
Well, that's just the first 10 minutes are quite different to the rest. But if you don't like heights, you won't enjoy this film. I thought it was really well done. I think I talked about it in Tissier on today.
Yes.
But anyway, Shazam obviously not out yet, but the early tracking is not good, it seems. It doesn't seem like it's going to make much. I don't know how they can tell this. I guess they're looking at how many people have pre-booked tickets and extrapolating, but unless it gets really good word of mouth.
Nah, and I've said it before, it doesn't work when the kids are growing up, because the whole idea of Shazam in the comic book universe is fine because Billy Batson will always remain a teenager, you know, so you always it doesn't work in real life.
And how crazy would it be if they're entirely rebooting the DCU into the DCU and the one bit they keep is Shazam?
That's true.
I mean, I love Zachary Levi, but no, that's not going to happen.
Jonathan Majors may be reuniting with his Da Five Bloods director Spike Lee in a film called The Understudy.
Is this connected in any way?
to?
Da Five Bloods.
Why do you say that?
Because they both start Da. Is that a thing that people do?
No clue. Ask the Germans.
It's going to sweep the boards at the Lolas.
Yeah. So synopsis is that it tells the story of life imitating art when the understudy of a Broadway production finds a role he's willing to kill for. So many killing here going on.
Mm, comedic killing. Is it comedic? Killing,
I have no clue.
Yeah. It's all happening for Jonathan Majors at the moment. He's obviously Kang and, as we're talking about today, Damon Creed 3, so he can pick what project he likes, I suppose. So
yeah. Cool. Big name now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not going to get any smaller over the next few years. He's going to play like a dozen. In fact, more than a dozen. But 200 Kangs. Al Pacino, Vince Vaughn, Michelle Monaghan are going to be teaming up for Easy's Waltz, which I think, if I remember rightly, is going to be on Amazon. It's been described as a mix of Swingers and A Star Is Born.
What is Swingers?
Swingers is great. It's early Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau. And it's a couple of guys. Well, they're the main two guys. They've got their kind of their crew. They're kind of young hopefuls in their early 20s. They go to Vegas. I think it's Vegas. And it's just them kind of hanging out and trying to find love and all this stuff. But it's just really well observed. It's very funny. It's touching. It's the kind of thing they should have kept doing rather than well, in fairness, Jon Favreau's had a great career, but Vince Vaughn, I think, went much broader. It's nice to see them do this stuff. So yeah, I definitely recommend checking out Swingers. It's difficult to see how this could be a mix of those two things. I guess just because Vince Vaughn's in it is maybe why they've thrown Swingers at the at that.
Cool. Yeah.
Have you ever heard the phrase "you're so money," or "you're so money and you don't even know it"?
Yeah,
that comes from Swingers.
Huh.
There you go.
Nice.
I think it may be Money Supermarket in this country took on in their adverts, "you're so Money Supermarket and you don't even know it." But that was them. That was a play on Swingers.
Ah, huh, fair enough. The very cluttered Nosferatu by Robert Eggers has added another cast member with Aaron Taylor Johnson. So we'll be joining Lily Rose Depp, Bill Skarsgård, Nicholas Holt, William Dafoe. He just keeps growing and growing.
There was someone we mentioned last time who's joining. I can't remember who it was.
Emma Corrin.
Yes. Yeah, big cast. Big cast.
Very big cast for a sidekick of Dracula.
Isn't Nosferatu Dracula?
Is he? I have no idea. No, oh yeah, that's true. You have to keep confusing the Nicholas Holt film with the Nicholas Holt film. Yes, that's the thing.
Is Nicholas Holt in both of these?
I think Nicholas Holt is in
Redfield. Or are you just wrong?
Maybe I could be just wrong, yeah.
Who knows? Anyway, both of these films have got large casts and maybe connected. It did look good, actually, the trailer for Renfield. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't yet.
Yeah, I can say nothing about this appealed to me. I saw the trailer and thought, this actually looks great. Paul Walter Hauser, who I've been a fan of for a while. I thought he was excellent in I, Tonya. Probably what he's best known for. He was
in Cruella as well.
Cruella, yeah. He's just joined Doug Liman's The Instigators, which is starring Matt Damon, Casey Affleck, and Oscar nominee Hong Chau. No word on what he's doing there, but if I had to guess, I'd say he's playing a slow-witted guy. He pushed really hard to play the Penguin in the Batman movie. He was like recording auditions and putting them on Instagram and stuff, and they did not want him. It was quite sad.
Colin Farrell did very well in it, though.
He did a great job. Yeah.
My last bit of news is that John Boyega is to star in a sci-fi romance called The Freshening. Yeah, a very dodgy topic because it's set in the near future where there are tensions over race and gender.
Okay.
And the US government institute a health initiative called The Freshening, where every American gets an injection, after which they only see everyone else in the same race as them.
I mean, I'm guessing this isn't supposed to be a comedy, but that sounds funny to me.
I know, right? It's So, at least it's different. I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's an idea.
Yeah.
Presumably, John Boyega is going to be playing American then.
Yeah, I guess so.
I'm so glad they stopped doing his switch your phone off in cinemas.
Is it still him though doing the voiceover for that?
I think it might be. I'm not sure.
Sounds like him though.
Yeah, it sounds like him, but I'm not 100% sure. But nothing against his thing. It was fine. It's just. we went for like 3 minutes, and I was like, I just want to watch a film.
It is really long.
Yeah.
There was one during the Jurassic Park time, there were even dinosaurs in that.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
That's nice. And had THX, in fact, I had 1138 in a reference to THX 1138. But I don't know, I go to the cinema enough that I get annoyed when I see the same thing over and over. I've got a few casting things, so I'll rattle through them.
Yep.
We've got Hannah Waddingham has joined Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. She's best known as the club owner in Ted Lasso.
Yep.
Jenna Ortega might be appearing in Beetlejuice 2, which I think we've talked about maybe happening. I didn't realise it was definitely happening. She's obviously having a big moment in Scream 6 and Wednesday.
Yep, I can see her in the Beetlejuice.
She kind of fits the mold, doesn't she?
She really does, yeah. Right? Like, yeah. She was presenting an award in the SAG Awards with Aubrey Plaza.
Classic, yes.
And that was hilarious, putting them two together. Yeah, they were basically deadpanning the whole time, the whole segment. It was very funny.
That's going to be tough for Aubrey Plaza, basically just seeing someone who's coming and taking all her roles. Mm. And Sydney Sweeney, who apparently is in White Lotus, is rumoured to be Spider-Woman in Madame Web. Which,
as in Jessica Drew.
Jessica Drew.
Huh.
I think. Huh. It's a rumour at the moment, because there was a suspicion that Dakota Johnson was going to be basically playing a version of Spider-Woman rather than the kind of traditional old lady Madame Web, because she's not old. So maybe Sony is trying to spin off a whole female Spider-Verse thing? That's enough news. Let's move on.
Yeah,
you
can cut on a bit.
I'm gonna cut some stuff, because I'm confused. Let's move on to See or Not to Zed, the segment where we talk about films we've recently seen and tell you, the listener, whether you should see them or not. Zed them, Zijan. What have you been watching?
I saw the film Bros.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. I'm not sure whether you've heard of it or seen of it.
I've seen a poster or two.
Yeah, I think they're doing some heavy marketing on it. So it's basically touted as one of the first gay romantic comedies by a major studio. It has an openly LGBT principal cast. It's written by Billy Eichner, who most people would know from his character Craig in Parks and Recreation.
Yes.
He also has a YouTube channel where Billy on the Street, where he goes about New York with celebrities and interview the people of New York on the celebrities.
Is that still going? I've seen clips of Billy on the Street. No,
that's not going on anymore. So, so he wrote the film, and he stars as a protagonist in this film as well, Bobby, because, you know, Billy, Bobby, same thing. it bombed at the box office, this film. It grossed only $14.8 million worldwide against a budget of $22 million. So good luck to Scarlett Johansson and Nancy Meyer.
Yep.
With their Netflix film. Yeah, so with this film, whether you like this film or not, solely depends on how much you like Billy Eichner as a comedian.
Okay.
Put it that way. I wasn't a big fan of his Parks and Rec character. He has a thing of, you know, the angry shouting thing.
That's what he does in this, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically. So, because I wasn't a big fan of it, so coming into it, this film, I was, not looking forward to it. And then he's basically playing himself, really.
I've never seen him do a range of characters, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I wasn't surprised that he didn't make a lot of money, because, I mean, it's really like a Marmite. This kind of comedy is really polarizing. So I just found the main character that he plays pretty hard to root for and insufferable at times. So for rom-com, you really want someone likable, honestly. So unfortunately, it just didn't do it for me. So sad times.
Fair enough. I don't mind him in small doses. I think his Parks and Rec is about enough. He's been in New Girl. He voiced Timon in the Lion King remake.
He did,
I forgot that. Small doses.
Very, very small doses. That's the only time I can stand it.
Fair enough. I've watched a few films recently, but I was trying to think what's actually interesting enough to talk about here, because it's not been fascinating. But I saw a film yesterday called The Trouble with Harry, which is an Alfred Hitchcock film. So it's not exactly fresh off the shelves, but I thought I'd talk about it. I like Hitchcock. I think, well, obviously, he's one of the greatest directors ever. I was going to say I've watched most of his films, but I don't think I have, because I think he made loads and loads and loads. But I've watched a lot of his films. This is definitely the most outright comedy of any of his films. So it's Harry is a character who very early on his dead body is discovered,
okay,
on a hill, and various people, both by four key people, interact with this. And I don't want to give away too much because there's a few twists and turns, but there's various people trying to avoid the police, and that's what various people kind of form relationships, fall in love, blah, 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 all around this body. It's quite breezy. It's maybe an hour and a half, hour 35, something like that. So it's okay. quite
quick. I like that.
It's always good. It is quite funny. It's actually quite risque at times, considering when it was made.
Uh-huh.
And I do a bit of improv comedy, and one of the things they tell is well, like, if your character reacts as if they don't care about stuff, it's quite funny once, but after a while, kind of, you want to see people react. You want to see them be emotionally affected by things. And pretty much no one in this film, after discovering this dead body, is at all bothered. They're like, ah, look at that dead body. And it kind of, that wears a bit thin. So you've got to get into that spirit of it. But once you're there, yeah, it's nice, light, breezy. Hitchcock is always good, so you're going to have fun. It would not be in my top 10 Hitchcocks to go and see, I think.
Have you seen 10 Hitchcock films, really?
But let's see how many Alfred Hitchcock films.
I've seen two.
You've seen two. Which two have you seen? You've seen Rebecca?
I've seen Rebecca, yes.
What's the other one?
I've seen The Birds.
The Birds. Let me see. Now, he made a lot of films in Britain before hitting it big, I think. So I've seen
Vertigo,
1, 2, 3, 4, I think, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. I think I've seen 20. One of those I'm not entirely sure. Some of the titles are a bit generic. So I was like, have I seen Sabotage? Maybe. So, yeah, so somewhere between 18 and 20.
That's pretty impressive, though.
Yeah, well, he's great. That's not... We should do a Hitchcock episode sometime. Wait a minute. Did I do a Hitchcock episode with Simon? I might have done. A long time ago. Anyway, this is quite fun. So, yeah, it's definitely worth a watch, but I say it wouldn't be in my essential Hitchcock collection, I think. Shall we move on then to our main topic of the day, which is the third Creed film, imaginatively titled Creed 3. Sijan, tell us about Creed 3.
So this is directed by Michael B. Jordan in his directorial debut. And it stars Michael B. Jordan as the titular Creed, Adonis Creed in this, the son of Apollo Creed from the Rocky films. This film doesn't star Sylvester Stallone, but Tessa Thompson reprises her role. Jonathan Majors joined the cast as former friend, childhood friend, and boxing prodigy Damian Anderson.
A.K.A. Dame, yes. As I say, it's the third Creed film. So in the first two, I think, were both directed by Ryan Coogler, weren't they?
And yes.
He was involved in the scripting of this, I think, but I don't know how much. Yes, the first one you introduced to Creed, he's this young up-and-coming boxer. Rocky is his mentor, kind of, I think, slightly reluctant mentor at first, and then takes him on, and he goes into all the boxing. I don't think he becomes world champion in the first one. Can't remember. In the second one, you see him take on the son of Victor Drago. Ivan Drago. I think the son is called Victor Drago. And Sly is still around trying to reconnect with his son. And yep. As you say, in this one, we don't have Rocky. And Michael B. Jordan is old and past it. And that was difficult for me to take on.
pretty much his.
Yeah, I mean, maybe in boxing terms he is. I don't know.
Yeah, he's pretty much retired from boxing this, and he's running his own gym at this point in time.
Yeah, he and Bianca are raising their daughter, who was born in the second film and was born without hearing. So we also have Tessa Thompson's character is losing her hearing over time as well, which was established in the first film. Usually we talk about going through the cast. It's one of these things that they're doing... We've seen Michael B. Jordan and Tess Thompson do this already, and they do it really well.
And we spoke about this before as well, at length.
Yeah. Because did we do an episode on Creed 2?
I think so.
Yeah. They're both still great, aren't they?
No, I love their relationship so much. My favorite bits of this film is basically the dynamic in the family.
Yeah.
Really, those are my favorite bits. You can cut out the boxing bits. I don't really care about it.
And this is, I think, getting really to the crux of the matter before we go into the details, is that, yeah, the family dynamic is fantastic. And there is more Tessa Thompson than the trailers led me to believe.
Yes.
I'd still like to see more.
Yes.
But the trailers have her give her one line or something. And which is, in fact, the line that she gets, maybe you have to fight him, isn't even in the film. I think in the film she says, if you've got to do that, then do that. But yes, it almost feels like Michael B. Jordan feels the same way. Is that all these great family scenes, great dynamic of them and looking after their daughter and how their marriage works and his relationship with his mother and all this. And then it's like, oh, we better have a boxing match at the end of this.
Yeah, because this is a boxing film after all. It's just weird though. Like, Michael B. Jordan has been saying that, there'll be a Creed 4. Like, I mean, how much more can you go with this storyline? Like,
well, there's talk of a whole Creed universe. TV series, maybe one about the daughter. Drago spin-off. Do you remember that quote I said on the podcast quite a while ago now from Sly Stallone talking about Irvin Winkler, I think it is, the producer, basically how much he hates him and his sons because they've taken the rights.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I don't know if we'll get the Drago spin-off, but maybe.
I really do not care much about the boxing at this point now. Like, it's just there as a subplot, maybe, but all I want to do is just go back to the family dynamic because I love to see them together.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you. I haven't seen the first two Creeds for a while, but I watched the proposal clip from Creed 2 the other day. Yeah. I think that's lovely. And I've forgotten that more gentrified in this, shall we say. I think kind of the place they're living obviously is huge, but also even things like their attitudes, the way they talk, they do seem to have kind of had some of the trappings of fame and fortune seem to have rubbed off, shall we say. Which is quite, I don't know whether that was deliberate, because that's what Dame is kind of rebelling against or pointing out, saying, oh, you've gone soft and you're just wealthy and you've forgotten where you've come from. And I thought, I like the way that was kind of carried into performances, but you maybe wouldn't see that unless you've seen the other two films recently.
No, that's true. That's true. I don't recall that.
No, it's only watching that again, thinking, okay, they sound a bit different. The language they use is different. We talked about Sly Stallone. So yep. He turned this down because it was too dark for him.
Huh.
The storyline.
Was it really?
Went to some dark places. I don't know whether...
Which bit?
He saw an earlier version of the script. I mean, I don't want to go into spoilers, but you do find there's about some stuff about Creed's upbringing that is a bit dark, but it's not. I mean, the first Rocky film, his job was breaking the thumbs of people who owed his mob boss money.
I mean, the first Rocky film, he tried to coerce the girlfriend from kissing him.
Yeah, I mean, there's darkness there. So I don't know whether the first draft or previous drafts of the script were darker than this and they got kind of sanded down.
Can't do this.
I think it makes sense that Creed stands on his own 2 feet and isn't just another Rocky film. But
yeah, as it should do.
I would have loved to see kind of like a final scene or final act, Sly Stallone turn up and saying, "Oh yeah, you did good, kid," kind of thing.
And then he does it in the next film again.
Yeah, that's all I want. I want him to come in 5 minutes every film and say, "You did good, kid." That's all I want. In fact, not just Creed films. Every film. Wouldn't Rocket Man have been a better film if Sly Stallone had come at the end and said, "You did good, kid"? when we talk about the greatest show on earth, you tell me that wouldn't have been better with Sly Stallone saying, "You did good, kid" at the end.
I think it could have worked there, to be fair.
It could have worked.
What do we think of Michael B. Jordan's directorial debut, really?
Really assured. I know that's a slightly damning faint phrase, but I thought really good, actually. It didn't feel like a debut to me. It felt like someone knew what they were doing. And he brought some nice ideas to the boxing scenes in particular.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah, what do you think?
They do a slow motion during the boxing scenes at the beginning, which I thought, and they zoom in quite well, which I really did like. You get to experience it in its full glory, really. No, I thought he's pretty solid. I think he does have a few too many close-ups sometimes, like when there's a dialogue happening and you're just focused at the person's face. Maybe it just be too many of that, but I think it's a very good good first effort.
Yeah, there's only one shot that I thought, I think it was a close-up of him shaking his head, and it felt, we'll come to it in spoilers, I think, or that scene. But no, by and large, I thought he brought some really nice ideas, because I know you've only seen, have you seen any Rocky films?
The first one for Lock Bay Oscar.
First one. Of course, yeah. But I've seen them all, and at least a couple of times, and most of them more than that. And there's only so much you can do with a boxing match. So it was quite nice to see, for the first time, he kind of took on kind of, I guess, magical realism maybe, but or just threw in some things that... Now, whenever I mention magical realism, Simon tells me that I've got it wrong, and then tells me his definition of magical realism. So I've probably got that wrong. But kind of, I don't know, the scenes where it's just the two of them in the ring and there's smoke all around them, and then you see the ropes of the ring become the cage, the bars of a cage. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, that was nice. I like that too. Yeah.
Apparently, he was inspired by Dragon Ball Z for some of this.
What, the film?
I don't know whether the film or
it can't be the film, right? The very much hated film, Dragon Ball.
Probably not the film. But he's a big fan of whatever that is.
That's an anime.
Anime, is it anime? Okay. So, and some of the punches did feel a bit anime-y.
So Ishk.
Yeah. So I get that. One criticism I would have of this film is that I think in general the Rocky films are very good at being quite simply saying things like, Rocky, if you get punched on your left side, you're going to go blind. And then it might be a bit hack and whatever else, but at least at that point you know, okay, that's what we're trying to avoid here. So every time he gets hit on the left side, you're like, oh no, that's really terrible. And you can see him trying to avoid being hit on the left side. And each film has got something like that. So, yeah, I don't know. This guy is really tall, and so you need to wear him out by running around a lot. Whatever it is. Okay. I didn't feel that we had that in this one, which made some of the boxing scenes, I was like, I'm not sure what's going on here. Like,
not sure what you're looking out for, basically.
Yeah, he's hit him, and people don't look happy about it, but I don't know why that's a bad thing. So I think we had things where he got, like, and this might be spoilers for the people who are going here for the boxing manoeuvres, but Dame hits the guy in the arm, and everyone's like, whoa, it's awful. I'm like,
it looks like a foul, right?
I guess it is a foul, if that's a thing.
But clearly it doesn't matter in boxing.
Well, maybe it does, because people react to like it did, but then the referee did. And if they just said something like, if they just made it a bit clearer to the non-boxing enthusiast viewer.
Which I think is quite a lot of us.
Yeah, like, is that something to watch out for? Is that bad? This is what I'm talking about with Michael B. Jordan shaking his head, but there's this scene where, Jonathan Majors, Dame won this fight, but everyone was unhappy in the way he did it. And I was like, I don't really know why.
Yep, me too. Yeah. I actually put a line in my Excel spreadsheet saying, I realize I completely don't understand boxing.
Yeah.
So same as you. I had the same experience as you. I also don't understand like how someone who's fresh out of jail, just by knocking out someone, suddenly becomes a champion. And now everyone reveals him. I don't understand how that works. I thought you need to build yourself up.
Yeah, I mean, that might be spoilers, but I think everyone knew that was going to happen, didn't they? Yeah, so let's not worry too much. Yeah, I mean, I think in reality that wouldn't happen, but technically, I think if you just beat the guy who's got the title, then you get the title. So you
just like that, easy.
Easy, yeah.
Wow.
I think that's how boxing works. I mean, in fairness, Rocky boxing is not always very accurate, particularly in the first two or three films. Well, actually, not so much the first one, but kind of films two and three, where he's just being hit in the head over and over and over with no attempt to block a punch. And I think, I'm pretty sure that's not how this works.
For me, it's just that there wasn't any build-up.
No.
For that. That's my criticism for that scene. Because suddenly, first of all, he's down on his luck, and Jonathan Majors plays this shy guy, you know, a little bit humble-ish, fake humble-ish at least. And then suddenly, overnight, he just became a worldwide sensation. Like, is this how it works?
So... I don't think anyone does get a title shot without working their way up, but technically there's no reason why you can't, I suppose. I did like his performance as this kind of, I think you say some of it maybe was faked, some of it maybe fake humility, but this kind of, it reminded me a bit of Tom Hardy in Venom, actually, but more appropriate here and done better. But it's kind of, he's been in jail for 18 years, whatever it is, and he's, really down on his luck, but he's still got this... pedigree from back in the day, trying to work his way back in. Shall we move into spoilers?
I think we've spoiled quite a few already anyway.
We probably have. Yeah. So let's continue with spoilers then.
Yeah.
So there was a twist of sorts. It was the most obvious twist I've ever seen in my life. So Michael B. Jordan, he's training up Chavez.
Yes.
And Chavez is the world champion, and he's going to be fighting against Drago, the son of Ivan Drago. He comes back from the previous film. But then Drago gets attacked. He gets Nancy Kerrigan'd, if you remember I, Tonya.
Yes.
And then it later turns out that Damon organised that, which I think was incredibly obvious. But the guy I sat next to in the cinema, when that happened, went, whoa!
Are you serious?
Out loud.
It was such a stupid review as well. Oh, look, they share the same picture in prison. Ooh, yeah. Oh, that's really bad. I mean, I saw that a mile away, so that was that.
Yeah, I mean, the second it happened, it's like, okay, Dame did this. I didn't even think it was supposed to be a twist. But the
apparently, to some people, it is. What other spoilers? Michael B. Jordan's mom is in this film. And she got a stroke.
Yeah, and died. I can't remember whether she's the same actress who was in Rocky IV. I don't think she is, but she's been studied throughout the Creed films. Yes, I thought that, because I guess the family dynamic, the subplot is Michael B. Jordan doesn't speak about his emotions, and Creed doesn't talk about his emotions, and Bianca Tess Thompson wants him to. That's kind of the, which I'm pretty sure they did in Rocky 3 or 4. But
it's basically a retread. We're going to see Creed's son of Creed.
Well, his daughter. His daughter is learning to box in this film. So, and kind of his mum dying, and also seeing how Dame acts kind of leads him to being closer to his wife and opening up, and wife, which is all lovely. The whole daughter thing. So the daughter wants to learn how to box like her dad. Bianca is very keen for her not to do that because she'll hurt herself. Did you feel that kind of petered out?
Yes, it kind of did. It just died out after that. They had this talk. I get the sentiment, but it definitely disappeared. I mean, they're literally bringing the daughter everywhere to all the father's matches. Like, I mean,
well, yeah, Bianca's like, yeah, let's sit in the front row and get blood spattered on you.
Exactly. No, it wasn't the father's matches, right? Like, she was there for Dame versus what's his name again?
Oh, Chavez.
Chavez, yeah, she was there as well.
I've forgotten that. Yeah.
I mean, how can you bring your daughter to all these boxing matches and expect her not to want to pick up gloves, right?
Because there was a scene where Adonis Creed says to his daughter, I'll teach you to box, but this is our secret, don't tell mum. Which is just terrible parenting.
Yeah,
horrible. And I was really expecting that to come back and him to learn don't do that and have a big fight about it. But it's never mentioned again. And then right at the end, Tess Thompson's like, yeah, great. Let's dance around in the boxing ring. Let's pretend to box. Let's have all a great time. Like, where did this come from? So I've given that the family dynamic was the strongest part of this film, it's a shame that we didn't have that kind of played out to its logical end rather than kind of being forgotten about. Whilst I'm doing criticisms, because I say I like this film, but I thought the training montage wasn't very good.
No, I thought it was pretty poor, to be honest.
Yeah. And again, it's been done
so many times.
Nine times in these films.
And much better as well.
But yeah, I think every single one has been better than this. This felt very phoned in. I mean, the whole Creed has to box again.
It's just weird, right? Why?
Tacked on.
Why? He's going to box and then retire straight after, right? So what's the point?
Yeah. So then it's like, well, you need to get yourself back in shape. But let's be honest. Michael B. Jordan was not out of shape. I mean, I know he's supposed to be retired. And there's the kind of got the scene where he's like showing his abs to Bianca. And he's like, yeah, this is not an old retired man. This is a guy.
I mean, you should have seen my abs.
I think you need a scalpel in 6 hours to find my abs. But dear. And the boxing match, as I say, had some imagination here, but the training montage, the music over the top just didn't feel like it works.
Yeah, it works, yeah.
And I know you're fighting against Eye of the Tiger. You're fighting against some of the great montages in film history. But, yeah, I wasn't impressed by that.
We did mention the flashbacks as well. So throughout this whole film, we see flashbacks when Dame and Creed were kids. And basically we're led to try to figure out what led to the falling out, what happened to Dame, why was he sent to jail, and then you see bits of pieces of, what happened was that Creed and Dame were assaulting a guy, and then Creed ran away. And what I didn't like as well was that there was no resolution to that, in the sense that, I mean, fine, because Bianca was saying, oh, you have to move or you have to forget about this, but you kind of assaulted the guy, you know. I know he was bad, he was abusing them in the foster home, so I get there's this justification, or at least try to justify that, but it doesn't justify the means, right? So I feel like,
I guess it's, because Leon is this guy, and this is the one that Bianca wants him to open up about. He's never mentioned it before. The films have very much never mentioned them before. So it's a bit of a retcon. Yeah, I guess that it's used as a finding ways to open up to his wife as opposed to learn the lesson not to fight. Which is, I mean, if the script had played that in a bit more carefully, it could have played nicely against the I don't want my daughter to fight.
Yes.
Storyline, it's right there, but and this is, I say, this is the darkness that Sly Sloane was talking about, was the kind of abusive guy. But, and again, I don't know whether there was more detail in an earlier cut or earlier script, but we just say there's a couple of lines about he used to beat them, and obviously that's terrible, but it's not like it's like the darkest thing that's ever been seen on screen, is it? It's it's fairly. I mean, I don't know what, I can't remember, this must be a PG-13, I guess, in America. It's not going into the detail. And it's a kind of a motif about him running away from stuff, and then you get Dame telling him he's running away again.
I kind of didn't like the resolution for that, really. Like, maybe they could put an end scene where, you know, he confronts Leon at the end or something like that. Like, because he just beat up some person in the middle of,
and
ran away, you know, so.
I think that would have been weird. I could have seen him maybe standing at, like, seeing that Leon, like, reading that Leon's dead or something.
That works as well.
Doing something with that.
Yeah.
Maybe kind of getting closure that way.
He just needs some kind of closure, in the sense that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was missing.
Because what they did try and do closure on was him and Dame after the final battle. So, spoilers, he beats him, unsurprisingly. And he's like, if you ever need a hand, give me a shout. We're still buddies. It's like, this guy had someone's hand broken. He's been apparently bad-mouthing your wife and daughter all over the news and all over the TV. I'm not sure you can just say, good luck to you, mate. Can you?
No, I don't understand that bit either.
I'd have to say, it felt like their dynamic was very insular. It didn't feel like Dame was suddenly heavyweight champion of the world to me. Like, I know he called into the TV boxing thing or whatever else, but it didn't feel like anyone else cared. It felt like it was just these two guys having a brawl. But hey.
What can you do?
What can you do? I think the cast is brilliant. I did like this film. It made me want to go back and watch the other two Creeds again. So I've got no complaints on that front. These are kind of nitpicking a bit, but I think
the cast is good. It's just the script needs.
It could have done with one more pass, couldn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. Like, I love the cast. I love the family bit. Like, spend all the time with the family. I don't care. Yeah. Just give me more time.
Yeah, and maybe sooner or later we're going to have that film that is about him, but it's not about boxing. I don't know how you do that, but.
Because we're not filmmakers here, are we?
We're not giving them ideas. And I think they've always done, well, not always. Rocky Five was rubbish, but they've generally done well in kind of mixing the plot lines. So it's you need to learn to open up to your wife, but also here's this boxing match. And I just felt they didn't quite land the duel bits here. But I'd say go and watch this. Definitely, I think this is a good one.
Yep.
And it's done really well at the box office. So Creed 4 is pretty much a certainty. And I guess that's my other thing. Like, what do you think the future... Let's set aside the kind of the TV series and spin-offs and stuff. What do you think is the future for Creed? You surely can't come out of retirement again.
Every single time, right? Yeah. Can you imagine? That's my turn.
Yeah. I mean, I know Rocky was still coming out of retirement in the sixth one.
Of course he is.
You got any ideas?
No, it's probably teaching the daughter to box, right? This is going to be $1 million baby too.
Oof. I hope they don't go down that route.
No, that's very depressing.
Yeah, you're probably right. It probably is teaching the daughter. If you're going to do that, you need to wait 5 years at least. I don't know how old she's supposed to be, but I'd say probably... In fact, she's probably 10 or so, so you're probably waiting 8 years. Maybe they'll age her up.
Yeah.
I was glad they didn't de-age them, by the way, for the flashbacks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad they actually got, you know, actors to do it.
They actually look like them.
They did. They did. Good stuff. Creed 3. My second favorite Creed film, probably. Maybe my third. Anyway, the first Creed was so good. We move on to a look back on Oscar, the segment where we talk about films that won the Best Picture Oscar in the past. As Zizan has already told us, this one was from 1952 and was the greatest show on earth. Zizan, what else can you tell us about it?
Oh, this film. Wow. Where do I start? We first saw The Greatest Show on Earth appearing in The Fablemans. I think that's why the impetus for us to cover this as well.
That's right.
Yeah, Steven Spielberg was watching this film, and basically it was his his first foray into film, and I think it drove his love for film.
And we see a big train crash, train and car crash, which apparently traumatized the young Spielberg.
Yeah, but it made him very curious about filmmaking in general. So this was the film that supposedly started off. Yeah, The Greatest Show on Earth. I'll put that as context right now.
Yes, okay.
Okay, so this film was directed by Cecil DeMille, B. DeMille. Yep. It's set in the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus. The film stars Betty Hutton and Cornel Wilde as trapeze artists competing for the center ring, and Charlton Heston as the circus manager. James Stewart also stars as this mysterious clown who never removes his makeup. In addition to the actors, the whole circus troupe appear in the film with its complement of 1,400 people, hundreds of animals, lots of animals as well. We're talking about sea lions, we're talking about lions, tigers, elephants, there were even giraffes, come on.
I had forgotten the giraffes. There were giraffes, yes.
There were giraffes and a hippopotamus as well.
Oh, yes, and a dog. Three dogs.
They also contributed 60 railroad cars of equipment and tents. Apparently, the actors learned their circus roles and participated in the acts as well. So, good for them. The film won 2 Academy Awards for Best Picture and Best Story.
Which I think was the equivalent of screenplay. Maybe, then. I don't know. Yes, if you love to watch the circus, but you don't want the immediacy of live theatre... you can watch the circus in this film. Best story. Did it have a story?
Well, it kind of did.
It kind of did.
Ish.
John Heston is running a circus and...
His lover accuses him of loving the circus more than her.
Yep. So she pairs off with the other chappie, and then the other girl pairs off with John Heston, and they switch partners right at the end.
As they do, because they love each other.
Which they seem quite convincingly to love each other before. The other couples. And then the train crash. I don't know. I must admit, watching The Fablemans, I was expecting the train crash to have more, you know, to be part of the plot more, rather than just, there's a couple of disgruntled guys and they decide to make a plane, make the train crash. That's what we're going to do. I didn't like this film very much, is what I'm getting at.
I
didn't hate it, but it's definitely in my bottom few for the ones we've done.
Me too. I think this film definitely will not work with modern sensibilities.
Well, there's that. Yes. Are you thinking, which of the many...
which of the many faux pas did he do? So I understand this was set in 1952, so I can appreciate when films are set back then and how things were. You know, circuses are well known for being cruel.
Yes. Yeah.
In general. And that's why circuses now are usually just, you know, performers just doing tricks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, I watch Cirque du Soleil and they're incredible, really. They're really, really incredible. But they're not like the circus in this film. In this film, it's like what I imagine like a circus when I was a child, where I was reading all those Enid Blyton books with Mr. Galileo, with all the animals and all the different kinds of characters in it. But what I meant by it doesn't, you know, meet with modern sensibilities is that it's very racist. They had they were laughing about putting on blackface on at one point, because they were saying, oh, we're going to be in the black, and one of the circus performers saying, oh, does that mean we have to put all blackface? That was a joke.
I thought it was quite a funny joke. I just thought it was no one did it.
Yeah. There were making fun of people who were overweight, who had dwarfism, which was very made for uncomfortable watching, I have to say.
Yes. Now, it very much, as you say, it was made in 52 and it lived by 52 sensibilities. Yeah. It also just, I say, it didn't age well quite quickly, not for the reasons you've given, I mean, maybe for those as well, but just in terms of no one was really talking about this film 10 years later.
No.
And I think looking at some of the comments about it, it's like it didn't live long in the memories. Cecil B. DeMille, I think I've not seen many Cecil B. DeMille films. This might be the second, but he's known for epics and like big budget and stuff. But maybe,
he likes his spectacle.
Yeah, but maybe not exactly high art. And it's fair to say this is all about the spectacle, really.
Yeah, I mean, half of this film is literally the circus performers performing and the audience members reacting to that performance.
Exactly. I mean, that's what I mean when I say there's not a lot of story, because it's like, now we're going to have the elephants parade. And then we just sit down for 10 minutes to watch the elephants parade.
Yep.
Like, yeah, if I wanted to watch that, I'd go to the actual circus. In Venice, I suppose I couldn't these days.
But I think I feel, that's true. But I think I feel like back then, it helps people, the circus reach a wider audience, right? I think, I imagine, it probably wasn't easy to watch a circus, and watching it through a cinema is probably the closest one can get. So maybe that's something.
Yeah, mate. Maybe. I don't really know how popular circuses were, but because they were touring in this film, so you would see that. I mean, and it's very impressive that the tricks and things that the performers did, as you say, they learned how to do a lot of these things.
That's quite incredible.
It's amazing. You definitely wouldn't. I mean, I don't know how much Zendaya did in Greatest Showman. I imagine she did some of the stuff, but they would never put her through some of the things that they.
No, for sure.
They did here. I've not seen much Charlton Heston, but I thought he was fine. Jimmy Stewart, I love. Did you recognise Jimmy Stewart?
Definitely not.
Yeah. Because I knew he was in it, actually, before seeing it. But I think I would have recognised him anyway, just because it's a very famous voice and I've seen a lot of his films. But I know we saw You Can't Take It With You recently. Have you seen any other James Stewart? Or was it?
No, not him. No. Yeah.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
No, I think he's great in it. The green screen work was shoddy at best.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think green screen existed, but yeah, the kind of the compositing of shots. Oh, yeah.
So bad. Sometimes you're just like, you can literally see the pixels where they weren't done right.
And some of them, I don't even know why they were doing it.
Yeah.
Like, do you really need that shot of them reacting? Come on. Yeah. Some of the cutaways to the crowd enjoying the show were people who I think were famous in 1952.
Oh, really?
In fact, I didn't recognise them, but apparently Bob Hope and Bing Crosby were there, who I thought I would have recognised. But I was looking through the list of people that were cut away to, and I didn't know who most of them were. But there was one thing where this guy was eating an ice cream for about 10 minutes, and I thought, why are we showing this? And I think he must have been famous.
This film won the Oscar when Singing in the Rain, that came out in the same year, was not nominated.
Not even nominated.
Picture.
Amazing, isn't it? Yeah, and it quite often comes towards the bottom of lists of the worst. Well, sorry, towards the bottom of the list of best picture Oscar winners. I mean, famously, we're putting Tom Jones bottom of all these lists.
Of course, right? I mean, Tom Jones is the worst by far.
But this is certainly in my bottom five, and probably to quite low. Yeah, in that five. So, I don't think rush out and see this.
No.
Right, next time it's Actor Factor. We're talking about the film's particular actors. Ijan, who are we talking about next time?
I'm surprised we haven't done him yet, but Christian Bale.
Have we not done Christian Bale?
No, I've looked at your spreadsheet. I don't think I saw him.
Spreadsheet
so
doesn't
you may correct me.
I recently bought Empire of the Sun on DVD. Maybe I'll try and get around to watching that for next time. Which means it's time for the final segment, the quiz, which is Reese Witherspoon romantic comedies.
I'm going to lose this so badly.
Did you see her on Netflix? Oh, not on Netflix, on Instagram listing her allegedly 9 romantic comedies? Although I've definitely thought of others that
they qualify. I haven't.
No, fair enough. I chose mine from that list just to... just to make sure that... So part of the reason I just realised I haven't picked a quiz topic for next time yet, so I'm going to have to think of something up.
No, it's all right.
It'll be fine.
Okay, I'll start first anyway.
Go for it.
Question one. In which film did Reese Witherspoon play a character called Melanie Smooter, who changed her surname to Carmichael to hide her origins?
Sweet Home Alabama.
Yep, that's correct.
I've seen pretty much all these films, I think.
I know, that's the thing. I've seen literally one.
In which film did Reese Witherspoon play product testing executive Lauren Scott?
Okay, I know it's not the most recent film. I know it's not Just Like Heaven. Let's see my list of questions. What are the films you should in? My questions. This Means War.
Correct.
Oh, really?
Very good.
That's my second question, so that's why it's here.
I've seen that film. It's not good.
Yeah. Question two. What organization does FDR and Tuck work for in This Means War?
I think they work for the CIA.
That's correct.
Oh, it's a toss-up between CIA and FBI. How Do You Know is, so far, the last film featuring which multi-Oscar winning actor?
It's the last film.
So it's, this actor, he, there you go, I'll give away it's a he, has won Oscars. He's made a lot of films, and this is the last one he's made so far.
I don't even know how, as a guess. When was this film out? There's no good help.
I'm not going to tell you, so...
No. I guess Christopher Plummer.
Well, it's not a bad guess. Jack Nicholson. I have also seen this film. It is not good.
Question three. Of all the four actors who played the four parents in Four Christmases, three of them are Oscar winners. Name two of them.
Ooh, that's a good question. I've not seen this one.
And the fourth one was also an Oscar nominee. So they're all Oscar nominees.
I've got a vague feeling Jack Nicholson's in this. I'm going to say... I think this is Vince Vaughn, isn't it? No, I'm going to have to say Shirley MacLaine and Jack Nicholson.
No. So you could go with either Robert Duvall,
all right,
Barry Steenburgen, or Sissy Spacek.
Okay.
The other parent was played by John White from Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Good question. Question three. What is Melanie's job in Sweet Home Alabama?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
This gives away why I was quite so sure that there was Melanie in this film. It was in my question.
What was the job? I feel like all the questions are all about her occupation.
there's a lot about that, sure.
She moved to New York, right?
Is that a job?
I don't know. She's definitely not an actuary.
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
I know she was an accountant in the most recent film, or she was studying for to be an accountant in the most recent film.
She was, yeah, yeah.
Oh my goodness, she was a doctor or something for Just Like Heaven, so that's that. Okay, think of an occupation that she was successful in because she moved to New York and she had to go back. Let's go with lawyer, simple.
Fashion designer.
Question four. Who was the producer of the film Home Again, whose daughter is also the director of the same film?
Ooh. I've got no idea. I've not seen Home Again, actually.
Oh.
So the daughter was the director?
Yes.
Ron Howard.
No. It's our queen of rom-coms, Nancy Meyers.
Ah. Cool. I didn't know she had a directing daughter.
Mm-hmm. Only that film, though.
Fair enough.
It bombed quite badly.
Okay. Yes, it didn't do well. Question four for you, a more recent one. In which year is the first scene of Your Place or Mine set?
What?
Have you seen Your Place or Mine?
No. Ah. You told me it was horrible in the last to see or not to say. Why would I watch it again?
Yeah, no, it's true. It's not good. But maybe
it came out this year. I think it was 20 years ago, so 2003.
Correct. Well worked out. Yeah.
My last question is, who recorded a cover of Just Like Heaven, originally by The Cure, to be used as a soundtrack of the film?
Katie Melua.
Yes.
Who sang a cover of The Cure's Just Like Heaven for the soundtrack of that film?
Katie Melua.
Great minds think alike. Of all the questions I could have asked about that film, it was the same question. Because I love that film, as you know. Well, it's a draw, Zijan. It's 3-all.
Finally, a draw.
There you go. You're getting back in there. We're going to quiz on the Deadpool movies.
Okay.
Because we've not done that.
Just two of them. Yeah.
And it was cropping up in our news section. What is our main topic for next time?
Shazam, Fury of the Gods.
Shazam, Fury of the Gods. I will do my utmost not to lose this episode, and we will see you then.
Please do, Colin. Bye.